From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
If Khaled El-Masri, whose nightmarish ordeal is known throughout the world, cannot pursue his claim because of so-called state secrets, then the CIA really has a blank check to shield even its most shameful conduct from any kind of judicial review.
The case of Khaled El-Masri, the German citizen who sued the CIA for illegally kidnapping him in Macedonia 2.5 years ago, we'll speak with his attorney, Ben Wisner. Then more than 330 people have been killed in Afghanistan in the past week. U.S. bombing raids continue and the Taliban are seizing large areas of the south. We'll speak with an Afghan human rights activist who fled to this country after documenting human rights abuses in Afghanistan. And we'll host a roundtable discussion on the Senate immigration bill expected to be voted on as early as today. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Senate has agreed to end debate on the controversial immigration bill, setting the stage for a vote likely to come today. The bill would heighten enforcement measures, establish a temporary guest worker program, punish employers who hire undocumented immigrants, and open a route to citizenship for at least some undocumented immigrants. If passed, the Senate bill would have to be reconciled with the Sensenbrenner bill passed by the House in December. That bill focuses strictly on enforcement and would consider undocumented immigrants to be felons. It would also make it a crime for priests, nuns, health care workers, and social workers to offer help to undocumented immigrants. We'll have more on the immigration bill later in the broadcast. In Iraq, a top leader has renewed calls for President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair to set a timetable for the withdrawal of occupying troops. This is Iraqi Vice President Tariq al-Hashemi.
2 days ago, we spoke with Tony Blair about this issue and the fact that it is necessary that the U.S. and British administration should put a timetable for its troops' withdrawal from Iraq. We have discussed this thoroughly, and I convinced him that the necessity of announcing a timetable for the withdrawal of the occupying troops, and told him frankly that Iraqis have a right to know when the last British or American soldier will leave Iraq.
Iraqi Vice President Tariq al-Hashemi. Bush and Blair have long rejected setting withdrawal timetables and vowed to withdraw troops at their own discretion. The two leaders are meeting today in Washington, with Iraq expected to top the agenda. In Somalia, an ongoing battle between rival militias has claimed the lives of at least 38 people in the last 2 days. The U.S. government has been accused of fueling civil war in Mogadishu through its support of warlords fighting Islamic militants. In East Timor, the government is appealing for foreign intervention to help contain more than 3 weeks of fighting between the military and a group of dismissed former soldiers. The fighting's killed at least 11 people and displaced thousands of others. Australian troops began arriving earlier today, with Portugal and New Zealand expected to follow by the end of the week. In the occupied territories, clashes are increasing between armed members of the traditional ruling party Fatah and the recently elected Hamas. On Wednesday, Nabil Hodhod, a security force commander linked to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, was killed in an attack in the Gaza Strip. Tensions between the two dominant Palestinian groups have led to the deaths of at least 10 people this month alone. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was in Washington Wednesday for his first visit since taking office 2 months ago. In a speech to Congress, Olmert addressed the international standoff over Iran's nuclear activities.
A nuclear Iran means a terrorist state could achieve the primary mission for which terrorists live and die, the mass destruction of innocent human life. This challenge, which I believe is the test of our time, is one the West cannot afford to fail.
The Israeli Prime Minister was addressing a joint session of Congress. Meanwhile, a New York Congress member is claiming victory in his attempt to force the Palestinian delegation at the United Nations to leave the United States. Congressmember Anthony Weiner, a Democrat, successfully added his amendment to the bill banning aid to the Palestinian Authority passed earlier this week. Referring to the delegation, Weiner said, quote, they should start packing their little Palestinian terrorist bags. Telecom spying and media control were the focus of a day of protest around the country Wednesday. Activists in several U.S. cities held rallies outside the headquarters of telecom companies that have become implicated in the NSA spy scandal and that have lobbied against net neutrality. Here in New York, Democracy Now! Caught up with a protest outside the offices of telecom giant Verizon. This is Betty Yu of Manhattan Neighborhood Network.
This COPE Act, if it were to be passed in Congress, could potentially dismantle public educational and governmental access TV, known as public access television. So it would dismantle the public access television stations in all the five boroughs here in New York City and the 3,000 access centers across the country. This would be damaging for our free speech, for our media democracy, and for many local communities that depend on public access, again, to have their voices heard.
Betty Yu of Manhattan Neighborhood Network. The special prosecutor in the Valerie Plame leak case has suggested he may be calling a new key witness, Vice President Dick Cheney. On Wednesday, special counsel Patrick Fitzgerald indicated Cheney could face questioning over his conversations with indicted chief of staff Louis Scooter Libby. The Justice Department is denying a news report. It's investigating Republican House Speaker Dennis Hastert. On Wednesday, ABC News cited federal officials in reporting Hastert was under investigation as part of the corruption probe centered around jailed Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Hastert denied the allegations and demanded a retraction. Meanwhile, the trial of former Bush administration official David Safavian is underway in Washington. Safavian, the White House's former chief procurement official, is charged with making false statements and obstructing investigations into Jack Abramoff's activities. Safavian's case is the first to go on trial in connection with a scandal over the Abramoff bribery scandal. And Sameh Hamouda has been released from jail. Hamouda is the Palestinian living in Florida who is charged as a co-conspirator in the government's terrorism case against jailed Palestinian professor and activist Sami Alarian. Hamouda remained in prison for months despite having been found not guilty of all charges against him. Hamouda was immediately escorted to the Miami airport for deportation to his family's home in Ramallah in the occupied territories. His deportation came just 2 days before a court-ordered deadline that would have forced authorities to explain why they have been keeping him in detention. Hamouda spoke to Democracy Now! From his prison cell earlier this month.
Everything was fabrication. Everything was a mere lie. Fat lies. This is what they did, and this is what they are insisting on doing to me and to continue my ordeal, only because I am a stateless Palestinian, that nobody is going to care about me, nobody is going to talk about my case. I am not a Christian, I am not a Jew, I am not a citizen of a powerful country that can ask about my destiny, about why the American government is abusing my rights. And I am very upset, I am very frustrated, and I think this American government now is taking the United States into a very dangerous situation where they are violating everything that belongs to human dignity and to human rights. They are violating all of the traditions of the United States. They are violating everything human in this life. They are dead.
Sameh Hamouda speaking to Democracy Now! From prison earlier this month. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for the full interview. He has been released after being detained for more than 3 years. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners and viewers. In Afghanistan, more than 330 people have died over the past week in some of the heaviest fighting since the war began almost 5 years ago. On Monday, U.S. A-10 fighter jets and Apache helicopter gunships bombed homes in the village of Azizi, west of Kandahar. The airstrikes, which lasted for hours, killed about 100 people, including as many as 30 civilians. U.S. officials said the raids targeted Taliban fighters who were involved in a series of deadly attacks last week.
The increase in fighting comes just 2 months before the United States is scheduled to hand over command of southern Afghanistan to NATO forces. Fighting has greatly increased in southern Afghanistan as the Taliban have moved out of the mountains and seized large areas of the region. Last week, the U.S. commander in Afghanistan, Army General Carl Eikenberry, admitted that the Taliban are now better trained, armed, and organized than in the past. He said the Taliban has adopted tactics used in Iraq, including suicide attacks and roadside bombs.
Meanwhile, the Afghan government has accused Pakistan of recruiting, training, and coordinating attack missions for the Taliban. Afghan President Hamid Karzai said quote, Pakistani intelligence gives military training to people and then sends them to Afghanistan with logistics. The Pakistani government, however, has rejected the charge.
We're joined right now from Boston by Habib Rahib. He is an Afghan human rights activist. Up until 2 years ago, he lived in Afghanistan, where he helped Human Rights Watch document human rights abuses committed by U.S. forces, including some similar to those that later surfaced in the Abu Ghraib scandal in Iraq. Habib Rahib is now a fellow at Harvard Law School, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
It's very good to have you with us. Can you start off by talking about the situation now in Afghanistan?
As you have mentioned right now, that the security situation in Afghanistan generally has gotten worse. And this scenario have actually started to get deteriorated from the moment that United States have toppled down the Taliban. At first, the Afghan people had a lot of hope that the international community and United States will bring peace and security and will establish a government that could help Afghan rebuild their society and to get rid of some of the bad and notorious warlords who used to perpetrate and used to violate human rights. But it didn't come true. However, I should mention that the security situation that has gotten worse recently, especially in the south and southeastern parts of Afghanistan, have many reasons, and there are many factors involved in it. Some of this could be attributed to internal affairs inside Afghanistan, and the policies that have United States adopted in Afghanistan or encourages that policy. And besides that, there are some of the factors that are outside Afghanistan, that are the interference of our neighbors, especially in the south, that as our President Hamid Karzai clearly and explicitly mentions ISI, Intelligence Service of Pakistan, that training, helping, and giving assistance to Taliban and encouraging them to come back into Afghanistan and to wage this war. So we have this picture in the south and southeast and southwest of Afghanistan that Taliban have become more organized, well-equipped, and they have now the ability to conduct military operation in a larger scale. While in the north part of Afghanistan, still we have some of the stronger warlords who enjoy impunity. And still there are some credible reports that some of these notorious warlords or perpetrators have their private prisons. But in generally, in other parts, the life of people, to some extent, have improved. Government have achieved significant successes, and women's rights, to some extent, have improved. However, I should add that it's not the way as it's been portrayed in the media that Afghanistan is a country or a success. There are huge challenges in front of Afghanistan and international community. Unless the international community double its assistance in both militarily and financially, Afghanistan's security situations will not improve. But I should add here that with consideration of this factor that helped Afghanistan, we should also pay attention that how our neighbor in the south of country will adjust its policies in regarding to Afghanistan. We have noticed that Pakistan have a double policy in regard to Afghanistan. On one side, it declares its commitment to fight against terrorism and al-Qaeda. On the other hand, there are elements inside the country, Pakistan, that are helping and supporting Taliban. That this double policy should be addressed.
Well, Habib, I'd like to ask you first to go back to the earlier part of your statement where you said that the Afghan people had a lot of hopes when the American occupation began, or that you have been responsible for several human rights reports in recent years that have raised questions about why some of that disillusionment might have set in. You know, you've reported about the impact of cluster bombs on the civilian population, American cluster bombs, and you've also reported about the abuses of prisoners in Afghanistan. To what degree have these kinds of abuses by United States forces and affected how the Afghan people regard the U.S. presence?
Well, still there are a lot of goodwill in Afghanistan that resonates in most parts of the country, except in the south part of the country, where Taliban actually manipulating the sentiment of Afghan people who have lost their hope because the central government and the international community could not reach to them. And Taliban are recruiting from this among this young people who have lost the hopes, and they don't see any good future for themselves. And the second thing, which I mentioned at the beginning, that Afghan people had hopes, and still that hope exists. If that hope does not exist, I think the security situation will get even worse. But the question is that how United States can preserve that goodwill, how the United States and the international community can do much better to start this goodwill that gradually diminishing even in the most parts of the country. And this is something that we want that the international community and the United States to reassess the policies that they have done. From right the beginning, United States, when toppled down Taliban, they handed over the control of most parts of the country to the warlords. And without any balance and check, they let them to do whatever they wanted to do. And there was not accountability. There was not pressure on them. And second thing, most of those bad people have been recruited inside the Afghan army and police forces. And still, some of those bad people are at the senior official positions in the army, in police forces, and also in Afghan cabinet and in Afghan parliament. So this is the scenario. When people look at this picture that sees that not much have been done, they say, and besides that, that less have been emphasized in international media and in Afghan media, that there is a lack of a strong commitment to fight morally against Taliban. Most of the time, it has been argued that let's have everyone, let's have an inclusive government to include all elements, including Taliban, except those person or people who have committed serious violations. So, but there has not been any challenge to Taliban to fight with the notion that Talibanism is a crime, because Talibanism was a crime and is a crime to stop women not to go to school and to burn school or to close the university doors or Afghan school and force everyone to obey what the Taliban were believing. So that's a strong violations. And because this has not been done, and also pressure has not been put on Pakistan to stop helping Taliban, there is a sense in Afghanistan among all people that there is not much hope. The security situation gotten worse. The economical situation has not improved. So people have lost, to some extent, the hope that did exist in the past.
Afghanistan has been, before the Taliban, a massive source of heroin, opium in the world. What is it today?
Well, opium production has decreased in the areas where the government has succeeded to control it, but it has spread to the other parts of the country. We have seen that in Afghanistan, that the Taliban, drug mafia, and some of the bad local commanders have all got together, and they act. They all together, these three elements have contributed to the deterioration of the security situation. Officially, there has been an indication or a decrease in the number of drug that's been produced, but it doesn't include. Unofficially, where it has spread to the other parts of the country, so it has been to some extent successful, just in the areas that the government has reached, but not in the other areas. Some of the reason is the promise that was given to farmers not to produce and cultivate the heroin. Or poppies have not been given to them. So this problem still exists, and any alternative means of productions have not been provided to the poor farmers.
Habib, your response to Hamid Karzai, the Afghan president, calling for an investigation into the U.S. airstrikes that killed 16 people, 16 civilians earlier this week?
Well, I personally did interview with some of the people who were killed in Uruzgan, if you remember, 2 years ago in a wedding party. And I remember that how the people who were injured and were in the hospital were unhappy and how much resentment was there. I remember after that, President Karzai assigned three ministers to do an investigation about that bombing in Uruzgan, but the result didn't come out. And this time, again, there is not much hope that this commission of investigation that President Karzai has asked and appointed will come to a conclusion and to release its finding publicly. But what I would like to say that the result of this finding should be publicized first, and then it should be a check of balance on the international troops who are conducting military operations. Because this kind of operation, maybe in a short term, just during the operation, may succeed killing a few Talibs. But generally, it will deteriorate. It will cause huge negative problems for the long term. I remember I talked with a girl who lost her mother, her brother, her sister, in the bombing in that wedding party. And she was saying, can I forgive United States? I will never, never forgive. And I will encourage all whoever I know to take guns and to fight against America. So this is the effect of this kind of operation. And I also conducted some of the research regarding the excessive military use or military power that the United States was using in law enforcement operation in Afghanistan and the negative effect that it was producing among the local community. This is something that should be addressed. If international community would like to help Afghanistan and to help Afghanistan government get as strong, there is a need that international community must behave accordingly to some of the internationally recognized law.
Habib Rahib, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Habib Rahib is a human rights activist who was forced to flee Afghanistan because of his work documenting human rights abuses and advocating that Afghan warlords implicated in war crimes should be brought to justice. Also responsible for the Human Rights Watch report that looked at the abuse of Afghan detainees by U.S. forces, which documented abuses similar to those that later surfaced in the Abu Ghraib scandal. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we go to Bernice Johnson Regan, who is singing at a memorial service for the human rights activist, founder of Black Voices for Peace, Damu Smith, this weekend in Washington, D.C. Our break. Bernice Johnson Regan, formerly with Sweet Honey and the Rock, the founder of that great musical organization, singing for Damu Smith, the late, great Damu Smith in Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn now to look at the immigration bill, which is expected to be voted on by the Senate as early as today. The bill, which has caused much debate in Congress, would heighten enforcement measures, establish a temporary guest worker program, punish employers who hire undocumented immigrants, and open a route to citizenship for at least some undocumented immigrants. But many immigrant advocates point to a number of adverse provisions in the bill that they say will actually bar millions from legalization, threaten their civil liberties, and declare English the country's national language.
If passed, the Senate bill would have to be reconciled with the draconian Sensenbrenner bill passed by the House in December. That bill focuses strictly on enforcement and would consider undocumented immigrants to be felons. It would also make it a crime for priests, nuns, healthcare workers, and other social workers to offer help to undocumented immigrants. The passage of the Sensenbrenner bill sparked the massive protests in support of immigrant rights that recently took place around the country.
To discuss this legislation, we're joined in our Firehouse studio by Stan Mark. He's the program director of the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund. In Miami, we're joined by Steve Forrester. He's the senior policy advocate for Haitian Women of Miami, which is an immigration advocacy and social services agency in Florida. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Stan Mark, can you start off by explaining your reaction to the Senate bill expected to be passed today?
I believe that the only thing that's comprehensive about this legislation, although it's supposed to be a compromise, it's been advocated as comprehensive legislation, is the fact that it's comprehensive enforcement, as mentioned earlier by Juan. There are so many provisions in there, I don't even know where to begin, but essentially what happens is there is a limit of due process, undermining due process, judicial review, administrative review, provisions there to allow for indefinite detention, which is contrary to current Supreme Court precedent. There was a decision earlier about 2001, but prior to 9/11, that essentially said that the ICE and the Department of Homeland Security could not detain people for more than 6 months without some kind of a hearing. If the provision that's in the compromise gets through, it will allow ICE or the Department of Homeland Security actually detain people beyond that point and without judicial administrative
ICE
review.
Being immigration,
that's
customs,
right,
enforcement.
That's correct. And there are other provisions in the bill that undermine judicial review and federal jurisdiction over any type of deportation or removal cases. It's a total evisceration of what our current system allows for, and it undermines due process and any type of defenses that people may have in removal proceedings. It accelerates and expedites removal for certain people. In addition, I think looking at the bill itself, if you look at individual provisions, it's one thing, but if you take it as a total package, it certainly is overwhelming and really detrimental and undermines our ability to represent or defend any of the people who are in detention.
Even on the issue of legalization, as I understand the final version now, it would still call for only 7 million of the 11 million people to get on the path immediately to citizenship, and for another...
Actually, our position is that it's more than 50% of people would be ineligible for legalization. Mm-hmm. I think some litigators and some people who have followed this much more closely in terms of their past experiences with the litigation program from 86 predict about 2 to 3 million people who may get through the first level. As you know, there's a three-tier system. First-tier system does allow people to, you know, eventually over a period of perhaps, more than 10, 15 years to actually get citizenship. And first step, of course, legalization. The second tier does not necessarily allow very many people to get through at all, and as a matter of fact, the third level actually creates a guest workers program, which we believe is tantamount to legalized slavery. As a famous official, Department of Labor official Lee G. Williams in the early 1960s, heading the Department of Labor when the Bracero program, the last major guest workers program that went through, was finally terminated, he called it, quote, legalized slavery, and we believe that any type of guest workers programs that reinstitutes those types of provisions or those provisions instituting programs like the Bracero program.
And am I correct in this also that those people who have been in the country a year or less would have to be deported? And in essence, there's at least a million people?
Theoretically, they could register and become so-called temporary workers, but most people there would be no reason for them to do that because they wouldn't gain very much in wages and better working conditions. But they would expose themselves to, being on the database and perhaps being removed later on. And they also would give up all their rights.
Why would a guest worker program be legalized slavery? What does it mean, a guest worker program?
Well, in terms of most guest workers programs in the past, have, and I think would be perpetuated in any type of guest worker program today, the lack of the absolute control of the workplace by employers with the government-sanctioned program itself being put in place, people would have very little rights to move from job to job. Their ability to depend on their ability to depend on employment would be tied to that type of job. They wouldn't be able to go from place to place. And historically, these types of programs open them to the most, make them most vulnerable to exploitation and really abuse by employers with very little avenues or options to get out of that kind of a situation.
We wanted to turn also to Miami, a large Haitian community there. Steve Forrester has worked with the Haitian community for many years. Steve, I remember speaking to you more than 10 years ago during the first coup against the president then, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, when tens of thousands of Haitians were fleeing the brutality there and coming into this country. Some were caught at Guantanamo who had HIV, AIDS. Now you're dealing with another situation with this bill. Can you talk about that?
Well, there are many problems with this bill. The first problem is the cutoff date, January 7, 2004. About 1.6 million people who arrived thereafter are left out. For the persons in the 2 to 5 year category before that, you only got 3 months to apply for this thing. There's no confidentiality in your application procedure and no right of appeal unless you deport yourself, as I understand it. Now, in terms of the people that we're particularly concerned about, there are many problems. You know, a lot of Haitians have green cards, just like all Americans. Nationalities have their green cards all over the place. There's a vast expansion of the definition of aggravated felon in this bill that means that you can be deported if, let's say, you've had a green card for 10 to 20 years. 30 years ago, you pled guilty to a bogus shoplifting charge. There's a vast expansion of that definition of aggravated felony to include the most minor misdemeanors, no matter how remote. In terms of specific Haitian concerns, you mentioned the people who came through Guantanamo with HIV. Those people are barred from legalizing. There's no waiver provision. That's a sentence of death. They're living healthy, productive lives here, but if they're deported to Haiti, the lack of medical care will mean simply they're not going to make it. And there are two other groups we're very concerned about. There's a bar to legalization for persons who have what's called final orders of deportation, and also persons who came into the country fleeing persecution with a fraudulent or phony document. Now, remember those 2 years you were just referring to. President Clinton was saying things like, they're chopping people's faces off. The United States led an international political and economic boycott of the Cedros dictatorship that killed thousands of people from 91 to 94. Yet our Coast Guard was still repatriating every boat person caught trying to flee. The only way out, especially if you were politically active, was to fly out with a phony document. At Miami International, these people said, my true name is such and such, I need political asylum. This bill bars them from legalizing. That's wrong. It violates basic American traditions. Also, persons who have been here for years and came forward early on to comply with U.S. law and identified themselves and were placed in proceedings, and it's gone through the process, and now they have orders of deportation that are final. Those persons also barred from legalizing. So this bill is riddled with problems. It's going to be a nightmare in enforcement, and probably millions of people are going to be left out.
We're talking to Steve Forrester, who is speaking to us from Miami. He works with the Haitian Women of Miami, concerned about the situation of Haitians under what could be this new bill if it's passed by the Senate. Of course, then there has to be a negotiation that takes place. Can you talk about going back in history and looking now, mentioning Guantanamo? People may not remember before the current detainees were held, there were Haitian detainees, those that were believed to be HIV positive or who had AIDS, who were fleeing the coup in Haiti, 1991 to 94. How does that connect to today?
Well, as you say, on September 30 of 91, I guess it was, President Aristide was overthrown in an extremely bloody coup. And for 3 years, there was the Raul Cedros military dictatorship. Everyone, the Haitian military knew precisely who had supported Aristide, because in the very brief seven-month period of his presidency, people all over the country had come out of the woodwork and joined community groups and plastered Aristide's photo all over their houses. So when the military crackdown occurred, they knew exactly who to target all over the country, and thousands of young people were killed in Haiti. And others fled. They fled by boat. And at first, they were taken to Guantanamo. A small number were let in at that time. Others, and among them, were HIV-positive persons who eventually were paroled in. And those are the people who've been here more than a decade, who they're not large in number, a couple hundred. But, of course, the test of a great nation is how it treats the most vulnerable. These people have been leading productive lives here. Under this bill, there is no possibility for them other than deportation. And, of course, lacking the care necessary, that's a sentence of death. We're also concerned for the people because this Guantanamo phenomenon, when they took some people to Guantanamo, only lasted 5 or 6 months. Then we continued the Coast Guard interdiction and repatriation of every boat person trying to flee. Haiti was a pressure cooker, if you will. And the only escape route for the most politically active and for anyone who needed to get out of that hellhole at the time under this military repression, well, there was a business profiting on the misery of these people. They flew out with a phony document, landed at Miami International Airport, gave their true names. That's the only reason they were paroled into the community, as they were, right away, and said, I need asylum. Now, those people had been here 12, 13, 14 years. They have U.S.-born children. They own houses, businesses, pay taxes, and send remittances back to Haiti that support thousands of relatives there. Those persons, they are barred from legalizing. So you have somebody like Gary Joinville, deported 2 years ago, an electrician, lived here since 93 with a wife and 3 U.S.-born children. He now is unemployed in Haiti because he was deported. The 3 U.S.-born children, who are the future of this community, not born in Haiti, don't speak Creole, as American as apple pie, if you will, they're constantly asking their mother, when's daddy coming back? Well, there are a few thousand people in this situation who had to flee repression using a bad document. We made Raoul Wallenberg an honorary U.S. citizen for helping people flee with bad documents, as we should have. And it is wrong to violate American tradition and asylum law and say that the very use of a document to flee repression and a repressive government that doesn't give travel documents to those it's persecuting is going to bar you from legalizing. That's wrong. It's wrong to bar from legalizing anyone who came forward early on and now has a final order of removal. They played by the rules. They went through the process. There's been a notorious history of discrimination in the processing of Haitians, and now they're to be deported too. So we're very concerned about the gaps. It's going to be necessary, hopefully with a Democratic Congress, to come back and try to fix some of these things. But as it stands now, this is bad for all kinds of people, and not to mention, as I mentioned at the beginning, people of all nationalities who have green cards. There's a vast expansion because of this sort of right-wing zealotry and enforcement stuff and scapegoating immigrants. There's a vast expansion of the definition of aggravated felon, so that that term, a term of art in immigration law, civil law, now includes the remotest misdemeanors of the most minor nature. So that you've got a green card, if I understand correctly, were this to become law, you'd have to watch out. And even if you had a green card for 10 or 15 years, that applies to Haitians and everyone else.
Well, I'd like to ask Stan Mark, then what do then immigrant rights advocates do in this situation? Because clearly you have millions of undocumented immigrants that are desperate in this country for some kind of legalization. Suddenly this watered down or right wing version in the Senate will now have to have to compete with an even more right wing version in the House. And as I've been saying, that there are some advocates who say defeat the entire thing and just wait till after the November elections to see a new Congress rather than take this this poison pill that it appears to be developing in the Senate and the House.
Well, I think that with the vote on cloture and the possibility of this really devastating bill passing through, the obvious thing is to oppose passage of it on the vote in the Senate, but at the same time to really look affirmatively and reframe the debate and link up with the mass movement, which has an upsurge. People didn't march and demonstrate for this kind of a compromise bill. Clearly, it does not meet the needs of people in our communities, both undocumented, documented, and citizens. It'll bust up families and many, many people who believe at this point that there is a possibility to legalize, I think, are fooled by this compromise. And we have to get the word out. For example,
but there are lots of groups immigrant groups in Washington and lots of Democratic Party leaders who say anything is better than nothing. Well, and so you're getting now a debate, obviously, that's percolating as to
Within the supporters of this compromise, I think there's probably some belief that this is the best we can do. But frankly, it's worse than anything getting through as far as we're concerned. And I believe that the opportunity with the mass movement and the major marches and demonstrations could help reframe this debate in the next session and perhaps actually ask for things that are very principled and that would help our communities in a better way. I mean, one thing that I really am concerned about is people believe that this legalization program will benefit a lot of people. If you've used false Social Security numbers, if you had used false names in your documentation in any way, shape, or form when you've hired employment, you would not be allowed to participate in this kind of a legalization program, which would knock out many, many people in our community. So it's a bad deal for everybody in the community.
Stan Mark, we want to thank you for being with us, Program Director of the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and Stephen Forrester from Miami, a senior policy advocate for Haitian Women of Miami. We thank you both for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that glitters is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Get up, stand up. Bob Marley here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to the case of Khalid El-Masri. He is the German citizen who sued the CIA for illegally kidnapping him in Macedonia 2.5 years ago. After accusing him of being a member of Al-Qaeda, the CIA flew him to a secret prison in Afghanistan and held him for 5 months. While in CIA custody, El-Masri says he was repeatedly beaten, drugged, roughly interrogated by masked men, detained in squalid conditions, and denied access to an attorney or his family. He was only released after the CIA realized they had detained the wrong man and left him alone on an abandoned road in Albania.
In December, El-Masri sued the United States, but last week, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia dismissed the case. Judge T.S. Ellis III ruled that holding the proceedings would jeopardize state secrets. In a moment, we'll be joined by Khaled El-Masri's attorney, Ben Weisner. But first, we hear Khaled El-Masri himself describing his treatment at the hands of the CIA. He spoke publicly for the first time last December, shortly after the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit on his behalf.
They took me to this room, and I had handcuffs, and I had a blindfold. And when the door was closed, I was beaten from all sides. I was hit from all sides. I then was humiliated.
And then
I could hear just like that I could hear that I was being photographed in the process when I was completely naked.
Then
my hands were tied on my back, to my back. I got a blindfold and they put chains to my ankles and a sack over my head. Just like the pictures we have seen from Guantanamo, for example. I was dragged brutally into the airplane
and
in the airport. I was thrown to the floor.
I was
tied to the floor and to the sides of the aeroplane.
At some point,
when I woke up again, I found myself in Afghanistan. I was brutally dragged off the airplane and put in the trunk of a car. I was thrown into the trunk of a car.
That was Khaled al-Masri describing how the CIA treated him after he was kidnapped in December of 2003. We're joined now by his attorney, Ben Wisner, of the American Civil Liberties Union, in our Firehouse studio. Ben, first, tell us about this live video satellite feed that came into the ACLU conference. Wasn't Khaled supposed to be with you live?
He was. I have to say, I'm always moved to see him speaking. This is a man with real courage, and he was very excited to come to the United States to tell his story to the international media and to tell it to the American people, seeking principally an acknowledgement and an apology from our government that these terrible events had occurred. To add insult to injury, when he arrived at Hartsfield International Airport in Atlanta, for absolutely no reason, he was turned back by immigration officials and put on a plane back to Europe after being detained for a few hours.
Detained again.
Well, no, that's right. That's right. And, you know, it was going through his mind that he might be sent to Guantanamo. Although he did have courage, he did go back, and we were able to arrange for him to appear live at our press conference by satellite feed. And so what you saw there was Khaled speaking live to the international media on December 6th, 2005.
Now, when he, as I understand it, when the CIA, after holding him for months, realized that they had the wrong person or that had an innocent person, they still kept him incarcerated and detained for weeks on end. Could you talk about that? And
one of the really striking things about this case is that we don't just have Khaled's account, which is remarkably credible and consistent, but we have had reports on the front pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post that have really given us a blow-by-blow of what was going on behind the scenes in the CIA and the State Department. And so we know from Dana Priest, who just won a Pulitzer Prize for this work, that Condoleezza Rice and George Tenet were told that an innocent person was being held in the Salt Pit prison outside Kabul. And they debated, what are we going to do? He's a German citizen. Is there a way that we cannot tell the German government? They decided they had to tell the German government. Meanwhile, Khaled sat there for months. He went on a hunger strike and was force-fed after 37 days of having eaten nothing. And it's my belief that had he not gone on a hunger strike, his detention may well have lasted longer and longer. The last thing they wanted was a dead German citizen in a secret prison in Afghanistan.
Now, tell us about the court decision last week. Khaled al-Masri sued the U.S. government for illegally detaining him.
What Khaled has wanted all along is an acknowledgement that he was a victim of this mistaken policy, an explanation for why an innocent person could have been subjected to this treatment, and an apology from the United States government. We filed a lawsuit in the federal court in Alexandria, Virginia, against former CIA Director George Tenet, as well as the private aviation companies that run the rendition taxis that fly people around the world for torture.
Their names?
Their names are, they're always changing. You know, these are probably shell companies, and so Keeler and Tate Management is one of them. PETS is another. But again, I mean, these are usually post office boxes somewhere that link back to the CIA. Interestingly, the defendants in this case did not come in and say, we didn't do this. They didn't come in and say, Khaled al-Masri has no right to compensation. The CIA, through Director Porter Goss, intervened in the lawsuit and asserted something called the state secrets privilege. What the CIA effectively said was, it doesn't matter if these allegations are true and false. In fact, we could never confirm whether they're true and false. Any litigation of this matter will jeopardize national security, will harm the United States, and therefore this court must dismiss the lawsuit. We had a hearing on that allegation, and days later, the federal judge in Alexandria did dismiss the case.
On the grounds of?
On the grounds of state secrets. And it's important for us to be talking about state secrets. This is the flavor of the month. Your viewers and listeners probably know of the case of Sybelle Edmonds, the FBI translator turned whistleblower. When she brought a lawsuit about her termination, that was dismissed on the grounds of state secrets. in the Electronic Frontier Foundation's lawsuit against the telecommunications for illegal NSA spying, the United States has moved to dismiss this case on the grounds of the state secrets privilege. We're going to say the same thing in the ACLU's and the Center for Constitutional Rights cases against the NSA. This is the way the government is trying to avoid not just accountability, but any judicial consideration of their illegality.
How often has state secrets been invoked by this president?
Well, more and more is the answer. There was an article yesterday in the Chicago Tribune that maybe your producers can link to that mentioned 6 or 7 cases in the last 2 years, but this is a doctrine that was only used a handful of times in the previous 25 years. And so what we're seeing is a privilege that would have validity if our government were run by honest people. We don't want our lawsuits to expose, for example, undercover CIA agents. That's not the intent. The question is why these lawsuits have to be dismissed altogether in order to protect against the possibility of those kinds of disclosures.
Now, what recourse is there for your client? Can he appeal this decision?
We will appeal. We'll appeal to the notoriously conservative Fourth Circuit in Richmond, Virginia. We have tried to raise this issue in the Supreme Court in the Sybelle Edmonds case. Sooner or later, the Supreme Court will have to take another look at the state secrets privilege. We are trying again to bring Khaled El-Masri to the United States. We hope to do that in late June, and we are going to bring him to Washington, and we are going to have him meet with members of Congress and to tell his story again. At the end of Judge Ellis's opinion dismissing this lawsuit, he states, if these allegations are true, this man has been wronged and he deserves a remedy. But that remedy can't come from the courts.
And what position has the German government taken on all this?
Well, that's another irony of this case, which is that the German government is actually investigating this case. There is an ongoing criminal investigation of Khaled El-Masri's kidnapping and detention. There's an ongoing parliamentary investigation of the role of the CIA and the role of the German government. We also have intergovernmental investigations from the Council of Europe, from the European Parliament. The only government that is not investigating this at all is the government of the United States.
We're talking to Ben Wisner. He is the attorney for Khaled El-Masri. I also want to ask you about the ACLU's new campaign to end illegal government spying. On Tuesday, ACLU affiliates in 20 states filed complaints to demand investigations into whether local telecommunications companies allowed the National Security Agency to spy on their customers. Here in New York, the New York Civil Liberties Union's Bill of Rights defense campaign spoke at a rally outside of Verizon's offices in Manhattan.
It is not up to Verizon, it is not up to AT&T to act as the court of law. If Verizon and other phone companies handed over to the National Security Agency the phone records of millions of innocent Americans without absolutely any court oversight, then they violated the law. They are responsible for the creation of the largest database in American history of billions of phone conversations and phone records of millions of innocent America. And they must be held accountable. Today...
Ben Wisner, your final response on this campaign of the ACLU.
Well, we're trying to get somebody to look at the president's illegal wiretapping campaign. We have brought a lawsuit against the NSA in a federal court in Michigan. We've now raised this issue under state law in at least 20 states around the country. The government is claiming secrecy. It's their way of avoiding accountability. But we're going to get a hearing on this someday. That's the lesson of Watergate.
Ben Wisner, thanks so much for being with us as we end today with a sneak preview of this upcoming Memorial Day on Democracy. Democracy Now! On Monday, we bring you an exclusive interview with the British Lieutenant Commander Steve Tatham, former head of the British Royal Navy's media operations in the Northern Arabian Gulf during the Iraq invasion. He's author of Losing Arab Hearts and Minds.
And there's a press briefing with American forces where all of the media are invited to attend. It's a sit-rep on the operational situation. But as Al Jazeera go into that briefing, they're stopped by a US officer and said, no, sorry, not you guys. You're a channel with a reputation. Now, perhaps it's my British sense of fair-mindedness, but it does seem paradoxical that we're inviting the rest of the world's media in and we're not too concerned about them, but the Arab media can't come in because we're concerned about their reputation or about what became the new four-letter word, their bias, one way or the other. And that struck me as entirely counterproductive to trying to win this war of ideas and explain who we were.
British Lieutenant Commander Steve Tatham, the former spokesperson for the British Navy during the Iraq War. We spoke to him at his home in Hampshire, England. We'll spend the hour with him on Memorial Day on Monday. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shrifa Bokadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin. Also special thanks to Frank Lopez and Jenny Utes, Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.